February 2014, armed men without insignia storm Crimea's parliament. Within hours, a new government is installed at gunpoint. The world watches as European territory is formally annexed for the first time since 1945. Yet Russian propaganda spins the story in reverse, claiming it's Kiev that suffered a coup. The bitter irony? Many of these masked gunmen were the same Berktet officers who had just killed protesters in Ukraine's capital. Months later, 298 innocent passengers aboard Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 would pay the ultimate price for Russia's proxy war, their plane shot from the sky over eastern Ukraine. This wasn't simply about Ukraine's internal politics. Putin's Russia was deliberately destabilizing its neighbor, fueled by dangerous myths that Russia had been humiliated after the Soviet collapse, that former USSR territories belonged to historical Russia by birthright, that NATO expansion threatened Russia with encirclement. These narratives provided convenient cover for a kleptocratic regime pursuing imperial ambitions dressed up as conservative values and Eurasian identity. The crisis exposed Europe's weakness in confronting hard power and America's failed strategy of leading from behind. More profoundly, it represented Ukraine's long-delayed anti-Soviet revolution, a unique fusion of passive resistance, Occupy-style protest, and traditional rebellion that would reshape the entire post-Soviet order. After the Berlin Wall fell, Europe dreamed of becoming whole and free. Intellectuals like Milan Kundera argued that Prague and Central Europe were the kidnapped West, artificially separated from their European heritage. By 2004, most former Soviet satellites had joined the EU and NATO, but Ukraine and Georgia remained in the waiting room. The expanded EU had transformed into what Robert Cooper called a postmodern entity, where security came through sovereignty sharing, rather than military might. Robert Kagan less charitably described Europe as turning away from power into a post-historical paradise of laws and transnational cooperation. By 2008, only France, the UK, and Poland met NATO's 2% GDP defense spending target. After the economic crisis, defense cuts deepened despite Russia's invasion of Georgia. Meanwhile, Russia had absorbed its own distorted version of postmodernism, not the EU's progressive values, but an ultra-cynical worldview where manipulation reigns supreme and no higher truth exists. The current conflict wasn't a simple Cold War replay, but involved a postmodern dictatorship combining old-fashioned military might with sophisticated exploitation of Western vulnerabilities. Modern Russia is controlled by political technologists, ultra-cynical manipulators who created fake democracy under Yeltsin and established a monopoly of manipulation under Putin. Vladislav Surkov, the Kremlin's puppet master, orchestrated every aspect of the political process until 2011. As political technologist Gleb Pavlovsky explained, in the 1990s, you couldn't use administrative structures. We had to work through the reality we created instead. Putin's presidency focused on building myths rather than institutions, simulating democracy through three narratives: conquest of the Caucasus, Russia as a rising BRIC economy, and creation of a vertical of power. By 2011, all three had collapsed. Even Putin admitted that 80% of presidential decrees weren't implemented. When protests erupted in 2011-12, an estimated 100,000 demonstrated, with slogans like, "Putin is a thief." Putin's conservative values project restored control through fear while redefining protesters as other. Russia's geopolitical thinking views small states as subjects, undeserving of sovereignty, emphasizing latent information management of the opponent's internal processes. Combined with political technology and the humiliation myth, these techniques created what amounts to a sociopathic state. The protests that became hashtag Euromaidan began November 21, 2013, when the government abandoned plans to sign the association agreement with the EU. The first protesters carried signs saying, "We are not paid," distinguishing themselves from the higher demonstrations that had become Ukraine's norm. These weren't simply middle-class revolutionaries. many were entrepreneurs and small business owners motivated by defensive concerns against the predatory state and rampant corporate raiding. By February, demographics shifted dramatically. Kyiv residents fell from 50% to 12%, while regional participation rose to 88%. The regime relied on hired thugs known as tatushki, off-duty police, security workers, gang members, and football fans. On January 16th, Parliament rammed through draconian laws criminalizing virtually everything protesters had been doing. Rather than intimidating protesters, these measures backfired spectacularly, radicalizing the opposition. The demonstrations became a strange hybrid. Protesters built medieval-style catapults and rocket launchers using designs downloaded from the internet onto smartphones at the front lines. On February 18th, a 20,000-person peace offensive turned violent when Parliament Speaker refused constitutional discussions. Police killed roughly 20 protesters while regaining control. That night, regime forces assaulted the Maidan, but protesters held their ground. 26 died that day. Despite Yanukovych declaring February 20 a day of mourning, protesters counterattacked at 7:30 a.m. Around 9 a.m., snipers began professionally targeting protesters with headshots from government buildings. Evidence later suggested Russian FSB involvement. By day's end, 70 dead, 166 missing, over 600 injured. Three EU foreign ministers arrived for emergency talks. The resulting agreement restored the 2004 constitution and scheduled December elections. But Yanukovych fled with an estimated $32 billion, despite having loyal security forces. By day's end, 70 dead, 166 missing, over 600 injured. Three EU foreign ministers arrived for emergency talks. The resulting agreement restored the 2004 constitution and scheduled December elections. But Yanukovych fled with an estimated $32 billion, despite having loyal security forces. Ukraine's revolution defied traditional paradigms. Protesters formed decentralized hundreds with sergeants, threw cobblestones, and used text messaging to coordinate movements and identify snipers. This hybrid approach, mixing violent and nonviolent tactics, suggests the future of resistance movements won't rely solely on peaceful methods. Putin's March 2014 victory speech portrayed Crimea as eternally Russian, citing Prince Vladimir's baptism and military history. This narrative ignores the Crimean Tatars' strongest historical claim. Crimea was only truly Russian for 73 years total, 1853 to 1917 and 1945 to 1954, comparable to its 60 years as Ukrainian, 1954-2014. The 1944 mass deportation of Crimean Tatars transformed the peninsula into something more Soviet than traditionally Russian. The takeover began February 22nd, when Burkitt forces returned from Kiev. On February 27th, at 4:20 a.m., 60 armed men seized power at gunpoint, installing Aksionov as prime minister while cutting communications. Russian forces without insignia, the Little Green Men, deployed 30,000-35,000 troops. The March 16 referendum claimed 96.7% support for union with Russia on 83.1% turnout, demographically impossible given Crimea's 24% Ukrainian and 13% Crimean Tatar populations. Independent Russian reports suggested actual turnout was 30 to 50%, with only 50 to 60% supporting union. Putin signed the annexation treaty March 18th. The Ukraine crisis introduced hybrid warfare, conventional forces creating background fear while insurgents operated with plausible deniability. Information warfare dominated, with manipulated media and non-state actors replacing traditional military blocs. Russia's aggression paradoxically revitalized NATO. Frontline states increased defense spending, with Latvia and Lithuania targeting 2% of GDP. Even neutral Sweden and Finland debated membership. The notion of avoiding conflict with Europe's energy supplier was flawed. Russia needed export income more than Europe needed the gas. Russia's economic damage was immediate. Capital flight doubled to $74.5 billion in early 2014, $191 billion in foreign debt came due, and international market access vanished. Despite Putin sheltering his inner circle, Russia's $740 billion corporate debt and foreign investment dependence made its position precarious. The crisis challenged the entire European security order. Russia gambled its economic future while violating international norms, forcing Europe to confront energy vulnerabilities. The contrast was stark. Russia's hard power proved immediately effective but fragile, while the EU couldn't conceptualize hard power as an option. Ukraine's struggle became a test of whether international law can survive when confronted by a state that weaponizes truth itself.